quote, "What I like about casinos is that they allow us to build hotels. A slot machine or a blackjack or a roulette table, they have no power. It's the non-casino stuff that gets people to come back again and again," close quote. With us today, the man who said that, and who by universal agreement reinvented Las Vegas, Steve Wynn. Shooting at the Wynn Las Vegas, Uncommon Knowledge, now. I have to ask you sort of the business school question. Do entrepreneurs just have a stomach they can stand more risk than the rest of us? Or doesn't it look risky to them? You could see things
both
that other
true.
People couldn't see.
But it's a very good question, and both are true. It's an uncomfortable way to live in many respects, because there's always a chance of failure.
Right.
And there are certain people, very intelligent people, who do not choose to live that way, and they're not wrong.
And they're called commercial bankers.
Or they're called regular folks.
Okay.
Entrepreneurs have an appetite for living uncomfortably that is a bit unusual. Truly living uncomfortably, because when you get a close-up look at running your own business, it's scary. However, having said that, I will also say that entrepreneurs who survive long enough to be interviewed by you are entrepreneurs who are not guys that fly without a net. It's one thing to be able to sustain risk and to live with a certain degree of uncertainty, to rely on your judgment. It's quite another thing to be reckless. When Michael Jackson asked me in an interview he did with me once, mm-hmm. when I introduced him to Siegfried and Roy, he wanted to do an illusion for his Thriller tour, and I introduced him to SNR. I had shown him a tour of the Mirage just before it opened.
Right.
And he was amazed. He said, "Do you get scared?" I said, "No." "But with all that thing that you're building," I said, "Look, Michael, before we broke ground, we developed a business plan. We re-examined again and again our fundamentals." I said, "We raised $525 million with some of the toughest people in the world because our story was convincing. By the time we broke ground, Michael, we were so sure of what we were doing that we did not think we were flying without a net or being a huge risk taker." And I said, "I think, in answer to your question,
right.
I think at the end of the day, you can live with the discomfort, but you're also self-critical. And I, speaking for myself and my colleagues, we never risk the farm. Never risk the farm. My responsibility to my employees, my stockholders, is such that I can't promise to be right all the time. No one can. You make calls, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But capital structure allows you to survive the inevitable cycles of business,
right.
which go up and down, as surely as sunrise and sunset, except we don't know the timing.
Right.
They allow you to survive your own miscalculation. Capital structure, I learned at a young age, thanks to Mike Milken, who taught me the story. Capital structure is everything. And I've always had a capital structure that was bulletproof.
You said earlier, when you were running your dad's bingo parlor in Maryland, you spotted a piece of land, you wanted to be a developer. And you've also said that, I quoted this right at the beginning, the reason you like casinos is because they let you build hotels. Still, they're casinos. Your dad was a compulsive gambler. It was a real problem for you growing up, for your mom, for your little brother. He left the family in debt. How do you think about, you need the casinos because they give you more revenue than just the rooms. They let the whole act take place, right? But you're still at some level, are you uncomfortable with the, how do you think about that in your own mind?
It is a central question, and I love it because I had to come to grips with it myself. Coming to grips with it is too strong a term. I understand it. My answer is this. There are all kinds of indulgences that people have that they do with their own money as they see fit if they come by it honestly. People spend money on wine that is outrageous. Women buy pairs of shoes that are beyond any need. People buy cars that are extravagant. They build homes that are bigger than shelter. Who is to define the necessities of life? And who is to tell us what our hobbies, our self-indulgences should or should not be. There are people who, the definition of a casino customer, a gambler, is a person who likes the game more than the money. The definition of an art collector is a person who likes the painting more than money. Right. The definition of a wine connoisseur is a person who loves the wine more than money. How can anybody pay $1,000 for an expendable bottle of wine that's gone in 3 minutes, or gamble for thousands of dollars, or even millions at a table? If it's their own money and they want to do it, that's their business. I am not judgmental about that unless I think someone doesn't know what they're doing or has got a problem. And we have rules around here about compulsive gamblers. We shoo them off. We don't give them credit. Nobody can get trouble who's a compulsive gambler unless someone gives them credit. If all they can lose is what's in their pocket, they'll never be in trouble. The trouble is when they can get money they don't have, you know, and they hawk the future. So my attitude is, we don't really hustle people to gamble. As a matter of fact, we're rather standoffish about it. What we do say is, if it happens to be that you like to play a slot machine or a shoot crap or baccarat or roulette or any of those games, come here. The experience will be more elegant. The service will be classier and better. The food will taste better. We will, if you want to stay at a great hotel, this is the place. And you can surely gamble while you're here. Or you don't gamble at all. Just bring your credit card and pay for it. Because we charge for stuff.
Right.
Last year, this casino won almost $880 million, something like that, which is the most in the history of legalized gaming in Nevada. But it was $1.1 billion in non-casino revenue. I think that begins to explain to you my attitude towards all this. And my places have gambling rooms. Good. If that's what you like to do, go at it. You don't want to do it? That's fine. This is still the best place to stay in terms of entertainment, food and beverage, conventions, and everything else. And so I've never had any problem. I've never had any cognitive dissonance about gambling because my dad was a compulsive gambler any more than I do have cognitive dissonance about the fact that you can buy liquor in this place and there are alcoholics.
Right.
What I do think is important that there be places that people can get treated for these miseries that destroy lives. Gambling, drug addiction, alcoholism. I was on the first board of trustees of the Pathological Gaming Institute with Dr. Robert Custer. I helped support it. He was the recognized guru of this field. Mm-hmm. And he explained to me, Dr. Custer explained that compulsive behavior in drugs, alcohol, and gambling are all related. They come from the same part of the brain. They common to the same personality traits. So if someone's a drug addict, he's possibly a gambling addict or an alcoholic.
Right.
The most important thing in treating this kind of misery is that first there be a place that people can go. But more importantly, in each case, the victim of such a compulsion must come to the conclusion they've had enough. With the help of their families or friends, they have to say, enough, I won't be victimized by this anymore. We learned from Dr. Custer that the existence of a legal casino has absolutely no impact on the amount of compulsive gambling that goes on. Because people that like to gamble compulsively will bet with their bookmaker, find a crap game, play poker privately, they will gamble and gamble and gamble until they get themselves in trouble.
Steve, onto the current Wynn Resorts, the current company, 2000, you sell Mirage Resorts to MGM for $6.6 billion. 2005, you opened the Wynn Las Vegas, in which we're seated right now, more than 2,700 rooms. 2006, you opened the Wynn Macau in the People's Republic of China, Special Administrative Region in Macau, 600 rooms and more than 200,000 square feet of gaming space. 2007, the Encore, the twin or partner resort to this, also the Encore Las Vegas. 2010, the Encore Macau, 400 rooms. Under construction right now, the Wynn Cotai, also in Macau. What's that?
Definite proof of pathological developer's disease. You need no more information than that.
And then you're also going through this lengthy political and regulatory process to win clearance to build a new resort in Everett, just outside Boston. That's projected to cost $1.6 billion right there by itself. Now, business question. Steve Wynn, quoted in Time magazine.
I'm in no danger to anybody, said my doctor, if I stay on my medication, except to myself.
This is you quoted in Time magazine in 2001, and that's before those billions of dollars of construction that I just read off. Quote, I'm frightened that in my isolation as a chairman who doesn't see everything, the bigger we get, that basically I don't really know what's going on. Close quote. Steve, how do you make sure, you're seated here in Las Vegas, how do you make sure the standards are being maintained in Macau? For that matter, how do you make sure that the rooms on the 18th floor are getting cleaned properly? Or how do you, what's this, there's a question here about span of control when you get to be this big. How do you infuse your standards, your approach, into an organization as big as this?
It's the question of all time. And the answer, as you get bigger, grows in importance in direct proportion to the size of the enterprise. And there is only one answer, the culture. The culture lives and must exist at the most fundamental level on the line employee in an enterprise like this, just as it must exist that way in the government. Who are we? What matters? Is that a simple question to which there is a simple answer that anybody working here can answer? If it is a simple question, it should be. Mm-hmm. We're offering people a good experience when they come and stay here overnight, whether they eat or play or go to the spa or swim or make a telephone call or walk down the hallway. What is it that we're all up to? We're giving people a positive experience, and only people make people happy. If I could establish that culture where each employee feels it's important to them to have responsibility, now for the guest experience,
right,
then your question is answered infinitely. So how do you do it? I'll tell you what. In this world, money's important if you're struggling and you have no security. But if you have a job and you think you're being paid fairly, money's not the issue anymore. What is important is their happiness, their state of mind, and their fundamental identification with the enterprise. If it's possible, that is to say, if performance on the job enhances self-esteem, you have plugged into the ultimate energy available on this planet. Money doesn't touch it. But if self-esteem is at risk in the way you do your job every day, now you got something. When you have programs like Employee of the Month, Employee of the Year, they're spotlight programs that give accolades and attention to the people who do great work.
Right.
It's very important, those things. But they all have one, those programs is important, and we use them. They have one drawback. They require that you be noticed by your supervisor and nominated for such accolade. So how can we eliminate that liability and turn nomination for accolades into something that the employee does on their own? We came up with that answer years ago. It's called storytelling. We retrained 12 or 1,300 supervisors. Anybody that met with three or more people, up to 15, these shift meetings take small groups.
Right.
We train them to do a thing every day, three times a day in this building or whenever the shift starts. The supervisor says in the small group, hey, anybody got a story of something good that happened yesterday with a customer? Employee pipes up and says, well, yesterday this happened and I did this. And it's really cool. The employee acted as an individual to help a guest on a very personal level. Bellman says, I took the people up to the room. In the suites, we tend to take the baggage with them up the elevator.
Right.
And the last thing the bellmen are trained to do is to say, check all your bags, everything here? Anything, can I explain to you stuff in the room? You know, do this sort of thing. And the woman, he said it was an older man and woman, the woman screeched, oh my God, Leonard, I left our bag with the medication on the hall table at home. He was an insulin-dependent diabetic. Oh my God, Leonard, what are we gonna do? Woman was very distressed. Bellman says, calm down, ma'am, we'll help you out. Where do you live? Pacific Palisades, Los Angeles. Is there anybody at your house? Yes, our housekeeper. Listen, my brother lives in Encino. Could you call your housekeeper and tell him that my brother, his name is Enrique, will come? Why, I promise you, we'll get it here for you. Don't worry. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. When do you need it? I need it by breakfast. Don't worry. She picks up the phone, calls the housekeeper, says, this young man's brother's going to come get it. And is the dot bag with the medicine on the hall table? Says, yes, Mrs. Whatever her name was, it's there. She looks, she hangs up the phone. He says, I'll take care of it. She says, are you sure we could go home? Nope, just my medicine's in there too. Just relax, you're going to get it. He goes downstairs, tells his boss, listen, tells him what happened upstairs. He said, listen, I'm just starting the shift. What the hell? I'll go see my brother. Let me off. I'll go get him. Jump in a car. I'll go get him. He says, okay. Kid drives to L.A., goes to his brother's house in Encino, picks up the bag, drives back, gets home at 3:30, 4 in the morning, takes it to the bell desk, see that this gets up to room X, Y. Now, do you think those people will ever dream of this building as a normal hotel?
Right.
Okay. Kid tells the story. That's a true story. Happened the first month, years and years ago.
Okay.
The boss says in front of the other employees, what a story that is. Presses a button on the phone, and up comes our crew with camera and recorder. On the in-house internet goes the story. Up on the wall within 3 hours is a great big picture of this bellman and his story in letters 3 inches tall on big paper signs in the staff area in this whole city below this building,
right,
next to the staff dining room. We made a hero. We published this story. Two things. The kid self-nominated himself for distinction. We made him famous. Number two, this is the part that matters. The other people in the room saw all this take transpire. And every one of them says, I got to get me a story.
Right.
Now I got 12,000 employees walking up and down this place looking for one of you guests with a problem. They can't wait to interact. I got dealers going on break that see a man or a woman looking around in this big place quizzically. You look like you're lost. Can I help you? Yeah, well, we're trying to find the Lafitte Ballroom. Well, you go straight down to the Chinese restaurant, take a left. Wait, come with me. I'm going to take you. We don't have to take it yourself. It's okay. I'm on break. Come on. They walk them to the, takes a 5-minute walk, delays his break by a few minutes. He wasn't that hungry anyway, but he's got a story. And he's going up on the internet tomorrow, and he's going to be a hero. That culture of making these people responsible in terms of their own self-esteem is the power. It's the power that makes a guy like me sleep good at night. Because I'm driving the culture, the employees are driving the experience. It's about my people. You got the culture, you got the problem solved on the 18th floor. You don't got the culture, you can have cops everywhere. Won't mean a damn thing.
Got it. Steve Wynn, 2011, quote, I'm saying it bluntly, this Obama administration is the greatest wet blanket to business and progress and job creation in my lifetime, close quote. It's 2014, Steve. You want to stick with that?
Absolutely.
You do?
Oh, sure. And I think that what may have been a sort of outrageously politically aggressive thing to say in 2011 has clearly come home now. The international president of my union, the restaurant and hotel employees union, has had his program exploded by Obamacare. He's begged the president in letters and in writing to change it, along with the Teamsters Union. They've attacked their own base with the Obamacare. Here in Las Vegas, the unions gave a $700 a year raise increase to the union, and 100% of it went to the healthcare program. And the head of the union says to me, when my members ask me, for $700 a year, I'm not getting a dime in my salary, it all went to healthcare, what am I getting in my health program that I didn't have last year? And he's gonna say, absolutely nothing. The exact same program. I mean, whether it's overregulation in a million areas, the amount of regulations published by the government in the last 6 years is staggering to anybody's imagination. There isn't a businessman in America that you can talk to that won't repeat the same mantra, whether he's a Democrat or Republican. And I've been more of a Democrat than a Republican in my day.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry Reid can attest to that. But the direction that the government and the government's taken in the last few years is disastrous from a whole bunch of points of view is disastrous to the future health and vitality of our society.
You're the chairman of a publicly traded company, and yet when it comes to politics, you take sides.
I take sides only on issues that pertain to the health of my workforce.
So
I am watching my employees get paid in 90-cent dollars. Although I have brought millions of dollars to the payroll of this American company from China, millions, tens of millions of dollars from China to my employees in America, it has not been able to offset the dramatic decrease in buying power of their paychecks. Walmart's more expensive. Gas is more expensive. Heating's more expensive. Clothing is more expensive. Why? Has everything in the world become more precious all of a sudden? Absolutely not. But the value of the dollar, the purchasing power of my employees, of the working class of America, is getting demolished by reckless fiscal policy in America, exacerbated by this administration.
So do you wish more CEOs spoke up?
What you're doing is unusual. To get well, that far out there,
listen, if you don't know the difference between good and bad, you're a damn fool to begin with. If you don't have a sense of protection for your employees, if you don't understand where your benefit as a CEO lies, it's with the workforce, then you shouldn't be holding that job. And if you know that it's your employees' welfare that matters, you're real concerned, not as a politician with rhetoric about the working class of America, but as a guy that's paying the working class of America, I know what's happening to them. And they're getting squashed by government policy. And so is education in America suffering from government policy. I mean, this is not soundbite stuff.
Steve, last question. Your dad died at 47, leaving you in debt. You took several years to pay off those debts, as I recall. And yet you have said this, quote, I'm quoting you, I'd give everything for 15 minutes with my father to have him walk through this hotel and see what happened, close quote. What would Michael Wynn say to his son, Steve?
My dad gave me everything I needed to get here today. He gave me a great education, his love and affection, my mom and dad. I had the most perfect middle-class childhood. My father never graduated high school, but was a self-educated man who read constantly and constantly taught me the importance of being respectful of people who worked hard and were successful because it was hard to do, to be a hustler, to work hard, to not take a breath until you got accomplished what you were after, to have a work ethic. And he gave me all the tools that I needed that a father could ever give a son to get to the point where I was armed for the battle, so to speak. My father was a pal of mine, a constant man that reinforced my insecurity when it occurred, as it does with young men. My dad was the perfect dad. He had a problem with gaming. He, like so many people of that generation that made their own money, who never had a dime, when they get money, they like to spend it. It's what's going on in China. First generation wealth always attacks because they think they can make more money. Second generation's a little bit more controlled and disciplined. My father was like most first generation Americans that were born before World War I. After World War II came into money and he was a consumer. So my dad had a problem, but as a father, everything that he aspired to in life happened to me. Every dream my dad ever had came true with his son. Knowing what that meant to my father is so overwhelmingly exciting that if my dad, there was a man in our city in upstate New York that was a Cadillac and tractor dealer. And then agricultural upstate New York, he was a good business. And he flew around with a pilot in a twin engine prop airplane, a little Piper Apache. My father said, "Hi, Sternberg has a pilot and a plane." That was like, I walk on my Boeing business jet or any jet or look at a painting or see the building. My dad was a customer in Las Vegas at the Tropicana. If my dad could have seen these places, in my father's world, I was the perfect success. Never mind what it means to me personally. To a guy like my dad, Mike Wynn, what I accomplished was the same thing as if I discovered a cure for cancer, if I won a Nobel Prize. And knowing my father's personality, I can't help but think that one of the most spectacular moments that a person could experience would be to see his face or to watch him process this after the fact. Of course, it's a complete fantasy, but it's the kind of thing that you love to dream about.
This past May, Forbes ranked you as the 133rd richest person in the United States. That places you not just in the top 1%, but in the top 1% of 1% of 1%. You're in good health.
Yep.
But you're in your early 70s, and although you have a lot more money than most people, you don't have any more time than anybody else. You've got you were diagnosed with an eye problem at the age of 29. Yep. It's unfortunately progressive. Mm-hmm. You said a moment ago that your dad taught you how to hustle. Why are you still hustling? Outside that window is a beautiful golf course. We have here a Picasso, a Leger, there's a Giacometti, and that's just a fraction of your collection. Why did you knock off? Golf, enjoy your collection. What keeps you hustling?
Because I'm one of those rarely fortunate, really lucky people who's doing what he loves. Consequently, I've never worked a day in my life. I love what I'm doing. I'm a student of creating spaces where people go, whoa, wow. I love that idea. And I've never been able to do it perfectly. Excuse me, I always think I have to do one more hotel because maybe, just maybe, I'll get it right the next time. And that quest to keep doing it, being a student of something that you love, is the most fun a guy can have. And I've been given the privilege of chasing this star to my heart's content by having the opportunity in China where budget's not important. You can just build for the ages. It's like being a pharaoh in Egypt where you could build a pyramid.
Why isn't budget important in China?
What do you mean?
Because the return on investment will be good no matter what you spend.
Got it.
Gaming has always represented that in Las Vegas for most years. You could build a great hotel here because you could justify the cost.
Right.
I'm hoping that's true in Boston. I believe it is. So we can have the first grand hotel in a city. There haven't been any in 50 years. There's no more Waldorfs or plazas anymore. The grand hotel doesn't work anymore in cities because the room, food, and beverage revenue doesn't justify the cost of construction. But if you can put a gaming room down the hall like a ballroom in a separate space, you can build a grand hotel in Boston. Bring back an age of grace and beautiful place where you can bring children because the gaming is off by itself. But I like places where everybody's excited. And it's a tricky thing to do because it's all about the emotion of the space. It's all about the way a building or a place or a staff makes someone feel. And that's a dynamic assignment. It involves human resources, things like storytelling, and making everybody in the building think that the best thing that ever happened to them was working in this place because you walk out of this room, forget my interview. And with your camera, grab any one of my employees. See what happens when you ask them, what's it like working here?
I didn't have a camera, but I asked a couple of people serving bar last night. They like your hotel, Steve.
The newspaper hired an outside consulting firm to find out who the Review Journal, who was the best employer in town. And they did these big interviews. And they did a special Sunday section. And we won. And I didn't know what was going on until Mike Weaver called me up and told me and read me what the employees said. Oh, it was ecstasy. This is the greatest place to work because they listen to you here. If you've got a good idea, they'll listen to you. This is a great place to work because they're sensitive to your family problems. They work with you when you have those problems. This is the best job I've ever had in my life. We're the best. This is the coolest place. There was this deep pride at belonging to the family here. In other words, it wasn't just the onyx or the marble or the hand-woven carpets or the fancy chandeliers and reflected ceiling plans that are so expensive. It was the living organism that is the family of staff. And if you get all those things going at one time, listen, last thing I got to say. By definition, on this planet, from Asia to Europe, from Latin America to Canada, there has to be a best hope place in the world to stay. Why can't it be here? Maybe we're the best hotel in the world. Maybe. Not for me to say. But you know what? From what I understand, from anybody that's ever taken and reviewed this objectively, if we're not it, we're in the top three. Now that's a kicky thing to be able to do.
Steve Wynn. founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of Wynn Resorts. Thank you. Shooting today in Las Vegas, in Mr. Wynn's villa at the Wynn in Las Vegas. For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson. Thank you.